Welcome back.
How was your lunch, Steve?
It was very good. And yourself?
Oh, not too bad at all. Excellent. All powered up and energized, ready for the next sessions.
Recaffeinated, refed, ready to go.
Isn't that good?
So, and it's important to be recaffeinated because we're going to talk about defining the end value of the software iteration. And that sounds like a dry topic.
Mm-hmm.
In reality, it's not. But it sounds like it. So, if you're caffeinated, you're well prepared, even though it should be exciting as we go. Let's keep moving. In this module, we're going to talk about eliciting requirements, estimating those requirements, documenting those requirements, and prioritizing those requirements. Whew! Sounds like a lot of work for a Scrum team to do. This is just all product owner, isn't it?
That's a lot of requirements.
That is. It is. Now, again, I want to stress, not just Scrum that we're looking at, mm-hmm. but across the board. And how do we do this in any type of organization? How will they do this? And then we'll want to say, how can we make it more effective and take some of these key principles we've learned to help us elicit the right level of requirement? So that's what we'll talk about today.
All right.
Eliciting requirements is our very first topic. And here's what the study guide has to say. Defining project requirements, reviewing and clarifying those requirements, defining acceptance criteria, defining UI platform requirements for web and mobile. Now, it's kind of not bolded here because I'm not going to talk about that at length. In fact, I think I've just talked about it the length I will. And then next, we'll be talking about assigning a business value and why is that important. So we're going to start off with a demo documenting lightweight requirements. So what should I cover in this demo?
Lots of exciting things, Steve, with color.
With color and lots of exciting things. All right. So let's talk about documenting some of the requirements. I am going back to Fabricam Fiber on this VM, and I'm going to use what's available here in the Scrum template to document these requirements.
Mm-hmm.
I may also jump out then and take a little quick look at CMMI just to see the deltas, even though I know we're going to come back and look at it later. But let's talk about what it looks like here. So here I am in my product backlog, and I'm going to open up a requirement or create a new requirement. Potentially with a new requirement, a service rep can view service dish ticket details from the dashboard. We might add a new one that says something like the service rep can view service ticket details on a Windows 8 phone, Windows phone. Okay, we'll click that in. That's added it right here. At this point, we're going to open it up, and this is an extraordinarily lightweight requirement. Now, you'll see a couple things that I just want to point out as I'm starting to understand and elicit this requirement. I'm going to be talking to people, understanding what they need, and one way to kind of get that together is this as a type of user, I want some goal so that some benefit or some reason. Very standard way of describing a description as part of a user story. We can use it, we can ditch it. That's totally up to you. But I'm going to specify some type of a description, and I want it to be light in Scrum. I don't want it to be big and heavy. It's got to be enough, but it's got to be light enough to give me, as a developer, an idea of what I need to do,
mm-hmm.
but not so heavy that I spend a lot of time up front. Remember, spending 3 weeks up front defining a requirement that's going to be implemented in 12 hours, probably not a good idea. You'd rather extend that development time out a few hours and then just have that collaboration with the business owner or the product developer at that point in time. That collaboration then becomes one of the key and important things.
So I find, while it's certainly a sentence there that we can throw away quite easily, I find that, you know, it's really, really helpful there. Just that little first part, you know, the type of user there, it's really great for helping the developer get into the mind of the persona, the actual user of the system. Because for the majority of us, the software that we develop isn't used by other developers. It's used by, you know, by end users who are really quite different. So helping, you know, having in that requirement, again, having that persona clearly spelt out, you know, as, think of something quickly, as...
How about as a service rep?
As a service rep, that works fine.
There we go, because that's where I'm building in my requirement. As a service representative of Fabricam Fiber,
mm-hmm.
I want to view service tickets on my Windows phone.
Mm-hmm.
But don't leave it there. I I think you're going beyond that. Why do I want to do that? Why do I want to see my service tickets on my phone? It's because I'm going to be traveling, I'm going to be in transit, and I need to be able to get new things on the fly potentially. So in other words, when we're looking at this, there's some subtle things that might pop out when I understand what the benefit is. Like for instance, I may realize I don't want to process service tickets and email them to them on their phone at the beginning of the day, because they may change service tickets. High priority ones may come up. You see, you get some of those without having to be so elaborate and descriptive.
Sounds good.
Okay, so I'm going to go back to here. As a service rep, I want to view service tickets on a Windows phone so that I can get new updates quickly while I'm on the road. Okay, very simple. We may then specify more. It's a common misconception that that's the only thing you'd ever put. You might type quite a bit in here.
Of course.
To specify some more details. I'm not going to here, because mm-hmm. we're in this discussion, but there may be a time when you do. Next thing you're going to want to do on this documentation is look a little bit at the overall effort. And we've talked about what that effort means. I'm going to drop this effort as a Fibonacci series. I'm going to come to this and talk it later, but I'm not going to use any number. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say it's maybe an 8. Fibonacci would be 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, etc. I usually chop it off at that point. And the next thing I'm going to define is a business value. Mm-hmm. Now this is me as the product owner. I've got my product owner hat on and I'm looking at the business value saying the service rep can view this service ticket details on a Windows phone. And I need to specify business value. How do I do that? There could be a number of ways. First is I may just flat out guesstimate, and I may have the Fibonacci series as well for this business value. Like really big business value might be 100, really little might be 1, and 20 is probably kind of that average business value in there. So, or maybe less. So I may put that in, or I might put it in as dollars. Mm-hmm. I could very well be a potential for dollars here. Then people start negotiating about that. Yeah. It gets a little bit hairy with dollars. So for business value, I'm going to use Fibonacci. I'm going to say it's a 13. Mm-hmm. 13 for me. And for business value, I've got a backlog priority. I might or might not assign that to an individual. I don't think that's important on here. But the important thing in here is the acceptance criteria that I'm going to specify at this time. Now, I realize I might be jumping ahead a little bit on my demonstrations, but the acceptance criteria are how a developer knows when they're done. This is what's it going to take for me as the product owner to accept this as a completion. And throw out some acceptance criteria that you might think are reasonable.
It must be able to be viewed both portrait and landscape.
Must be viewed in portrait and landscape. Did I misspell portrait? Yes, I did. Not going to fix it. Must receive updates over the air.
That's right.
It's kind of one of the more obvious ones on a Windows phone.
Does the update include the address of where we're going?
Ah, updates must include address. Oh my goodness, if I have an address, what else do I need?
We should be able to map where it is.
Map where it is.
And where we are.
Map location of mm-hmm. address. And potentially get route from current location to destination address. You get the idea. I'm spelling out some of these key items that are going to be critical for me to know when I am done as a developer. I'm going to have a... Can I have my soapbox back for just a moment?
Oh, my God. Yes, temporarily.
Temporarily.
With a rope attached. I'm going to pull that back.
I'm going to take a moment to soapbox for a moment. The word requirement can be something that can drive me crazy. And it's not because requirements aren't required. In general, they often are. But I look at those big 50 to 200-page documents I used to get as a developer, and I look at those, and as I read through them, the vast majority of the requirements weren't required. A lot of them were nice-to-haves. And I don't think people appreciate how important it is to deliver a small chunk that you can get very fast feedback on and redirect your efforts if appropriate and if necessary. So that goal of having this big fleshed out requirement can sometimes be problematic because mixed in with the things that are truly required are things that really honestly are just nice to haves. And I want to make sure that we don't mix those in together. That's why these nice concrete, small, easily prioritized requirements and easily delivered requirements are important.
Can I add something to that?
Absolutely.
So one of the things that I commonly come up with is organizations that are well invested in those historical requirements documents, the big multi-hundred page documents with all this information in there, and trying to get the BA off that into creating user stories. They often think of that as being more involved than necessarily it needs to be. So what I'll do is often have just a pre-created requirements document, and I'll open up a user story, and really it then becomes a copy-paste. Now, just to add to what you were saying there, the acceptance criteria, that's not new because your process has changed. The acceptance criteria should have already been in there in the requirements doc. But the interesting thing is when I copy and paste those across to say, well, it's just the form that's changing, often we're not pasting the whole lot across. Because we realize as part of that exercise, you know what, that doesn't really fit the need. It was probably, you know, you can get rid of a lot of that superfluous padding from those documents sometimes.
Oh my goodness, that is such a good idea because it brings something else that I think is important, mm-hmm. which is a lot of times people will ask me, how do I just automate this process? I've got these big documents, just dump them over. And you don't necessarily want to.
No.
You want to put that effort into thinking about the requirements mm-hmm. again as you're making that translation. That's a really good point.
And it's great because you generally find that people don't bring the majority across. Maybe not the majority, but you start to lose a lot of the gold plating.
Yeah.
In that exercise.
Okay, I've got a story. I've got to divert to a story. So a while back, I was working with a company that had very large requirements, and they were struggling to get to this independent level where they had really more fine-grained requirements. And the development team was always struggling with the business analysts, saying, give us smaller requirements. It never seemed to happen. Well, time went by, and this idea of acceptance criteria kind of caught hold. And it got all the way up to the CIO. And the CIO said, absolutely, every requirement, this document, should come with a list of acceptance criteria so we know concretely when that requirement was delivered. Well, these were very complicated, very large documents. And what was so much fun is the announcement meeting, I got to participate in the announcement meeting, and I was in there watching as the CIO said, kind of a new idea, we're going to have every documented requirement come with all of the acceptance criteria necessary to validate that requirement. Big, fat requirement. And one of the BAs just bolted to his feet and shouted out, that's impossible. Do you know how complicated that would be? And immediately just went red-faced, sat down, and all the developers roared. Because if the business analyst doesn't, it's too complicated for them to come up mm-hmm. with acceptance criteria, how are developers supposed to be able to code that? It's a very difficult problem. Mm-hmm. I thought it was funny.
No.
I've
seen the same kind of thing. I haven't seen people jump up and embarrass themselves quite like that. But the same thing, that push back from that person in the BA role going, well, I haven't got time to do that. This time excuse is extraordinary, but you've got time to have the team build the wrong thing or create it incomplete. It just seems like an
Absolutely.
Absurd thing to say. Yeah,
it does. All right, let's jump back in. I'm going to go back to my screen and again look at my product backlog item. I've got it all laid out here. I've got my acceptance criteria, my basic description. I've assigned a business value, effort, and I think I'm ready to close it up for a bit. Mm-hmm. Might not be completely done yet. There might be that big, giant requirements document out on SharePoint, in which case I might go to links and I may create a new link to that document on SharePoint. Okay. I can do that here, or of course you can do it right in the description as well. You can put in, you can put requirements at http://foo.com and it'll you could paste in your link directly there as well.
So we're not absolutely getting rid of it, are we?
Not absolutely. Not all the time. And the fact is, if you've got those big fleshed out requirements and somebody gave them to me, I'm probably not going to throw them out just so I could get a 3x5 note card. I'm probably going to want those around. So if I've got them, I'll take them. but they're probably going to slow down my overall delivery process if I have to wait months for them to be delivered to me.
I'm impressed with your requirements. A 3x5 is about like this big. How much do you get on there?
Ah, 3 inch by 5. See, there we go. So very US-ism, isn't it?
It is.
Yes. All right. So I'm going to save and close this. And, well, you know, there's one more thing that I do want to mention, that we see this flat ordered thing here. Mm-hmm. It is definitely possible to create child requirements that fall under this in Scrum. So you might have an epic that sits at the above these with child nodes underneath them, and they're just displayed as a parent child in this environment. Don't need to show it, but that's an available thing for people. In case they're building epics or larger requirements that have to be broken down and maybe cross sprints. All right, I'm going to pop back over to the PowerPoint presentation, and that's my first go at that requirement. I'm going to come back to that requirement and do a little bit more to it soon.
Sounds great.
All right. Estimating requirements. Now, how do you estimate? Yes.
2 days.
2 days. 2 days. Let's see, I think it's going to be 2 days. So I better pad that to 4. And now I remember that sometime I got punished for missing a date. So let's say 8.
Double it again.
Exactly. One more time. And then you hand it to the project manager, and they double it before they hand it up. It gets to the product owner, who says, bah, too expensive, let's not do it. So
that's how it works.
It's how it works. Let's talk about estimation. How do we manage and assign the effort estimates? In this case, we're going to talk mostly about story points. Resizing user requirements into smaller, more manageable pieces. How do we do that? And then executing a task breakdown. And I'm going to turn it over to you for the task breakdown piece on this one. And then estimating the requirements baseline. I don't have it bolded here because I'm not going to dive into this in detail. And the requirements baseline is really where we're laying out, this is what we think we're going to deliver in a release. We baseline that and say, this is it. And then if there are any changes, we note those as additional scope. The evil scope creep. Do you have scope creep in Scrum?
No.
No. Why not?
Because it's bad and it's evil.
Because you don't have to have scope creep. It all depends on how you treat things, right? In Scrum, immediately upon finishing a sprint, I may go looking out and see in my backlog an entirely different backlog than I saw before, and that's okay. You don't have scope creep in Scrum and most agile methodologies. You may have a little where people are, you know, sliding things into a sprint that, but the official adding big requirements, et cetera.
Well, scope creep is change. So in this particular example that we're talking about, I mean, Agile and Scrum embraces that change. We acknowledge that change is inevitable. Mm-hmm. So again, we just don't have that scope creep. When something changes onto the backlog, prioritized, brought into the next one. And sometimes the reality is we will get things into the in-flight sprint. The give and take, if we really, really have to put something in, which we frown upon, we have to take something out to make it fit. And that's fine. That, it just works really, really well. And that's part of embracing the change.
I agree wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's jump into some of what that might look like. Story points. And we didn't talk about story points in Scrum. Story points aren't officially part of Scrum, but very common for Scrum teams. Some form of effort that it takes. And story points are useful because they're an arbitrary measure. They're not tied to days where people argue over 5 days versus 6 days. It's an estimate of how hard it is, and they're imprecise specifically so that we recognize in our industry that we have a problem with variation. And there was a comment or a question that I'd love to come back to later on, which talked about variation and why do we as an industry have variation? It's so desperately a problem for us. And I'll come back with maybe it's desperately a problem, but the fix would cost more than the solution than the problem. But it's what's interesting about story points is they're very team specific. Your team may have a velocity of 38 story points. I may have the same number of people, and my velocity is 150.
Just have we defined what velocity is?
Oh, I kind of touched on it. But that's a good point.
Okay,
I'll let you take that.
No, I just wasn't sure that we've actually said what the velocity is for the team. So if we, and it always takes a couple of sprints to get this up there. Now, I do remember that you did have on a slide earlier, you showed some
Leading indicators and trailing indicators?
I remember. No. Okay. Not that one. Evil Steve. So what we had there was when you were doing the forecasting, we saw, I think it was 38 and then 41, and then it looked like we were going to do 40 something like that. So what that is that's for the same team, how many points of effort can we do in each given sprint?
Yep.
So again, just for that clarity, I just didn't know whether we'd spelt that out. So a team's velocity is how many story points they can deliver upon in a particular increment.
Right. Okay. And the fact that I'm delivering 150 mm-hmm. and you're delivering 38 mm-hmm. doesn't mean my team is, you know, so much more efficient than yours, you know, four times as efficient. Mm-hmm. It's not the case. It's just that our estimates might just include, you know, we have just higher numbers that we use. Mm-hmm. Again, they're an arbitrary team-specific thing, not very effective for measuring against teams. No.
But there's a lot of things that can affect that. So typically team composition can come into play. After probably two or three sprints, the team starts to gel.
Yeah.
The team starts to sort of, you know each other. We've got the interpersonal stuff happening. And we then start to stabilize or standardize on that velocity. And, of course, you start juggling people around and throw the velocity out the window.
Yeah.
You know, dysfunctions could introduce into the team. The velocity could change. Conversely, by keeping the team the same through the estimation processes that you're talking about, it's interesting to start seeing that a team that estimates together stays together. No, sorry, that wasn't where I was going. As a team that estimates together, pretty soon we'll throw a card up and the team will suddenly just look at it and go, it's a five.
Yeah.
You know, we'll just, we won't have these crazy 13s and 1s and 2s unless there's something genuinely unexpected there.
Well, you mentioned something interesting. They throw out a card and the team all agrees it's a 5. Mm-hmm. How do you avoid some of the bias that occurs if someone says, that's a 30, and then someone says, oh, no, it's not that big, it's a 20?
I want to know how they played a 30 for a start.
Okay.
I'll teach you Fibonacci later.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's say 40 on a rounded Fibonacci.
So anchoring. You know, if we don't know what we're doing, if we're not quite sure, I'm sort of looking over to see what the guy to my right's going to play because he's really smart at this stuff. So I think he's going to play an 8, so I'll play an 8 too because then I'll be right as well.
You mentioned playing an 8. What do you mean by that?
So Steve's going to talk to us about poker planning is my guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
A little bit later. And I've probably just...
Actually, you're just going to talk about it right now. That's why I'm letting you talk about it.
Thank you, my friend.
It's right at the bottom of my screen, and it's all yours.
Okay, I've just taken over your session. Thank you. So something, and David started a really good presentation at the ALM Summit earlier this year. So ALM Summit 3, he did a really good talk that's available on Channel 9 that goes into software estimation. And he talks about a whole lot of different things you can use. So firstly, planning poker isn't the only one. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely not a silver bullet. But I've seen it really work for many teams. So you can get these cards, and when I talk about the story cards, well, you can write them down on a paper napkin, or you can buy some really nice quality cards online, or you can get applications for your Windows phone or for the web. It doesn't matter how you do it. So what we do is we'll get the team together, because remember, we want the team to do the estimate. Why? Because the team's accountable for it. We don't want the team to have a ready-made or built-in excuse. Oh, I don't have to really do this in a half a day because, well, Fred estimated it, so if I miss, it's his fault, not mine. No, perfect ready-made excuse. Everyone should have buy-in to that estimate. Then we feel more ownership of it. So what we'll do is we'll put a card up there. We'll pick a benchmark. Something that everyone can relate to. And I'll normally try, if I've got a prioritized deck, I'll look through the comparative sizes, and I'll try and find one that's usually a 3 or a 5. I like to try and keep them down around the 3s. So let's say something we can all relate to. Washing the outside of a family car and vacuuming it. You know, something that everyone can relate to, we might call that our team's 3. Now, everything that comes up, we're going to compare to that 3. So if it's changing the tyres on the car with the one in the boot, sorry, let me localise that, in the trunk. So that
I don't know if you have to. We've got people from all over attending. So the boot or the trunk?
The boot or the trunk. So we're going to compare the effort to that 3. And I might say it's probably about twice as much effort. So looking at my cards, I've got a 5. I'll probably go with the 5 or maybe step up to the 8. But I'll keep that card, and in many cases, I'll hold it up to my forehead. I don't want anyone else to see it. I want to avoid that anchoring process.
Yep.
When everyone's got a card up there, I'll go 1, 2, 3, and then we'll reveal what those estimates were. And that's to try and avoid, you know, everyone anchoring.
Yep.
Now, I don't know that it's... I mean, I've seen teams play the game slightly differently. I'm also a big fan of, if you can't spend 30 seconds justifying the number you pick, you've got no right picking it. You know, if I've never, ever changed tyres on a car, don't guess. That doesn't actually help anyone. I would rather see that team member just put the cards down.
Sure.
Because if I've got 30 seconds to justify my 5 and I start with, there's no value. There's just no value there.
Well, this brings me to an interesting point, because you're asking the team to make this justification or this estimate. Who is best suited to make that estimate? If I'm the scrum master and I've been with the team for years, shouldn't I just be picking those numbers for them?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
Absolutely not. So again, that's the scrum master overstepping.
Okay.
And it comes back to the whole...
I'm the product owner.
It smells...
I know how big these things are. Shouldn't I then do it?
It's got a smell.
Okay.
It smells like that project manager who's got, you know, conflicting interest. You know, they're rewarded for getting this out the door sooner rather than later. You know, they're going to be biased to keep those estimates small.
Or
they're going to be biased the other way because they're tired of getting booted in the pants for being late. You know, we want to avoid this fudge factor that's become a common practice. I don't want to be late, I'll double it, then he'll double it, then he'll double it. We suddenly start dealing with things so far removed from what we believe is accurate, and we just put this padding in there to protect ourselves.
And
it's just frustrating.
I have two comments.
Sure.
I think the first comment is around padding. The most expensive thing in software development is time. We have a very limited amount of time to deliver something. This is time to market, time to repair a bug. These are the things we're measured on, is this cycle time. It's almost the most important thing we can do is get our feature to market quickly. So why would we buffer with the most expensive possible resource, which is time?
Mm-hmm.
You don't buffer the most you don't use the most expensive resource to buffer
Correct.
Your delivery. You would buffer it instead by hiring a whole bunch of contractors and bringing them onto the team and maybe using them at some point in time. That's, I think, maybe goes a little bit deeper than we need to talk here, but it's I think it's an important concept. The second thing, I love the way you put that, which was to say we have a team that gets together and plays planning poker so that we can reach a consensus on the sizing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably the best way that we can get an estimate. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. So so we go around, and consensus is interesting. Don't try. And again, people play the game slightly differently. Don't wait till we get a unanimous result. You know, it'll never happen and rarely happen. And arguing over a 5 and an 8 with two strong personalities, it's not going to add value.
And it doesn't really matter.
No.
It doesn't really matter. Yeah.
So there's a few things like, as the scrum master, for want of a better role, I'll just look around there. I'll look for the highs and the lows, the outliers, and try and find out why. So Steve, for the card for changing the tires, Steve comes out and plays a 1. Another team member plays a 13. And they play the 13 and it's like, well, how about you go first? Well, it's really, really complicated and the cars are heavy and I'm probably not strong enough and a bit wishy-washy. Steve plays his 1.
I was a pit crew in the Formula 1, right? Man!
Steve comes out and states that he knows that they've got a compressor downstairs with a rattle gun, we've got a nice trolley jack that'll whack that back of the car up with no effort at all.
Yeah.
And using his experience and knowledge, he's now adding value.
Right.
And that's what we're really wanting to try and find there, is the unique value there. Now,
I'm going to cut you off. Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
I don't want to make my point. So now I hold grudges. I harbor grudges.
Well, this is just coming back for the scrum, the Kanban one.
Oh,
no,
nice.
No, seriously. Go ahead and wrap the planning poker, and I'm going to step
straight
on
over
just to make
you.
Sure we hit the timing.
Thank you. So. So we've got the one, the fringe benefit of that process, of course, is that everyone learns that changing the tires is actually really easy. We learn the resources we've got. It could be that we've got to do some cryptography for some of the credit card details. And someone goes, well, a project that I worked on 6 months ago, we've already got it. It's sitting in the version control system. So, you know, while we were all going to be conservative and go with the 20 because crypto sounds hard, well, it's already done. We've just got to reuse that code base, wire up some tests, we're done.
I am really glad I didn't cut you off because that's a very important point.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Resizing requirements.
All right.
In order to deliver value continuously in this rapid cadence, we got to have sufficiently small requirements. Now, what does that mean? It doesn't mean that they're trivially tiny, but it does mean that they're small enough to get delivered. And it, maybe this comes a little bit of strong influence in kind of the zeitgeist in the software development community right now is this lean startup idea. What is the minimally viable product that we can ship that will have business value? And that value may be just learning for us, so we go the right direction, or it could be something completely different. But think about shipping the smallest possible item. What can we do there? Now, some thoughts. I mentioned this earlier. Not everything in a 200-page requirement is required. And if you can skip a small requirement or ship it independently or something, do that. Take the small requirement that's not really a requirement and throw it away. If it's a requirement that you can ship quickly, get it up there and get it out the door. Decomposing requirements. Can I turn this over to you?
More than happy to take it.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
All right. How about I do it as a demonstration? Let's see my screen here.
All right.
Okay, so I'm not using the exact same virtual machine that Steve's using there, so just very quickly, what I'm going to do is pop over into the web access. And I love the web access in 2012. It just rocks. I'm going to go in and add a product backlog item in here, and I'll say pay for items in the cart using PayPal. I'll go ahead and, in the interest of time, I'm just going to say typity-type. There's our description.
Perfect.
Even in the interest of time, I'm not going to leave out my acceptance criteria. I just refuse to.
Thank you very much. Thank you. That's well said.
I'll go ahead and say
it may be blah, 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 but they are the acceptance criteria.
Excellent. I might choose the owner of that particular requirement and save it. So just a very, very quick backlog item. Steve, you've gone through that already. So
correct.
We'll just let that save, or else my TFS wakes up on the VM. I'm going to go and view my backlog. There he is. Now, during our sprint planning meeting, we're going to want to go and do some decomposition here. So what I might do is close your eyes for a second as I drop that into the current sprint. You didn't see that. And I'm going to find, sitting down the bottom here, this little plus button. Now I can go and click that plus button, and as a team member, I can now decompose these into the individual tasks. Now I can say that I want to go in and add PayPal branding to the website. I'm just going to leave the typos there. It adds a sense of genuineness.
yes, it does.
I'm going to arbitrarily... Yeah, something that's right-sized as a task. I look at that and I think, well, that's going to take me about an hour. Not a story point. I'm down to a task. So when they're decomposed to this small level, I have a much better opportunity to visualize everything that's required, to understand it in its entirety because it is right-sized and small. So this
well
is about said. This is about an hour there. And I may choose to go and say this is a... I'll go with a development task for now for want of a better one, and I'll quickly save that. So I can go and decompose that down into as many tasks as that's going to require me to do. I will also very, very quickly... So based on one of the acceptance criteria over here, we can only charge in USD. That's one of the acceptance criteria. Why did I close it? I'm going to go and have a look at my test cases. So during this meeting, you know, I've got testers. Testers are part of my team. We don't give them labels. They are team members. So I'm going to go into test cases and say I want to create a new child task. And I'll say test payment using Australian dollars. I might put a little note there. It should fail. That's entirely up to you. That's just a placeholder for me. I'll say OK, and the new test case work item is created. Now, notice there's a link here. It is automatically linked back to the requirement for that much-needed traceability. You talked about that in the first module.
Yep.
You know, traceability, absolutely imperative. Okay. So I won't put the steps in here. We don't know how this is going to appear in the UI yet. I don't know what screens it's going to be on, but I know there's got to be this test. And,
yep,
of course, this is a negative test. We're going to have a corresponding positive test. So for now, I'm just going to go ahead and save and close that. And I've decomposed that requirement down into just one task for now, in the interest of time, and a single test case. How's that?
Brilliant. Nailed it. Exactly it. So I'm going to jump back, take it back. Mm-hmm. Sorry for cutting you off. I feel awful.
That was fine.
I know, but okay. Back to documenting requirements. In documenting requirements, we're going to talk about a few more things. Now we've got them fleshed out. We've decomposed them a little bit. Let's talk about defining particular acceptance criteria. Here's what the study guide says: defining acceptance criteria, listing requirements. You got a backlog here. You've got a place where you get the... We're not going to cover that in detail. Adding requirement details. I think we covered that already. But designing UI storyboards, we haven't talked about. And except at the very beginning where I wanted to tie this back to the acceptance criteria, storyboard as being this picture has 1,000 words kind of thing. So we're going to go ahead and do that. And we're going to start off with a demonstration back into Team Foundation Server. So I'm going to pop into... my virtual machine, and let's open up our service rep can view tickets on the screen, and we're going to lay out these acceptance criteria once again. Now we've got the acceptance criteria laid out, but I'm going to take your idea and start adding some test cases as well, because I want to make that tie-in. So I'm going to do the same thing you just did, going over to test cases, but I might do it slightly differently. I could use a different tool. For instance, I could fire it up in MTM. So I could fire up the Microsoft Test Manager and make sure that I am tied into the correct project, Fabricam Fiber, and the Fabricam Fiber project, and connect to that. And from here, I'm able to now start adding requirements. So it's another way we can add that traceability. It's important that you see that testers have their own tools, their own ways of working, but it all ties into this one thing. So we're going to add all these requirements. I'm just going to run the whole thing. And what one was that? It was a Windows 8 one, right? Let's go down here. Service rep can view service details. There it is. That's the right one. So let's go ahead and add those requirements to the plan. And now I'm going to be testing this requirement with a set of test cases. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that during the planning meeting, we should start fleshing out these test cases, just at a high level, maybe titles only. And I love that because my tasks as a developer, I'm fleshing out with titles only as well. Mm-hmm. But immediately after that, when I'm going to work, I need to be adding more details. So I'm going to go in here and I'm going to add a new test case. But I'm going to add it for this. Git route from current location to destination address. Mm-hmm. That might be one. Or must receive updates over the air. Let's do that one. Must receive updates over the air. So I'm going to go back to MTM, entering my title, service ticket updates must be received over the air. Now, you mentioned something that struck me. We don't even have a UI. We haven't even started the Windows Phone development, so what do I do with test steps? And I'm of the mind that the developers should execute test cases before they check in their code. Well, they can't do that unless they've got a test case to bounce it against. So I'm going to enter some pretty generic stuff. I'm going to say open up web portal to update an existing service request, update the request with a new address, and my expected result is that within 2 minutes, the service tech's phone has received the update, and they've been has received the update. I was going to say, and they've been given an audible alert. That wasn't part of my acceptance criteria. Not going to put it in part of my test. If it passes, close the portal. Now, this is crazy. This is just some totally generic tests, absolutely unrelated to, like you were mentioning, the key things. What do you click? Who do you log in as? I don't know yet. We don't even have users assigned yet. We're starting right out the gate. But I'm going to save and close this because I want to now talk a little bit about one of the key things in quality. And it's coming up, I talked about it before, this acceptance test-driven quality piece. Mm-hmm. And I want to come back to it because I find it very compelling that we have a business requirement. And I might even go to camera for this one, if I may. We may have a business requirement, and we're going to take that requirement, and in a waterfall approach, we're going to take the requirement, decompose it into tasks that implement a technical view of a business problem. Developers build it all and then hand it to testers. Well, what are testers going to test? Let's be honest. They've got the application in front of them. They're going to test the correctness, technically, of the technical implementation of the interpretation of the business requirements. Now, what you identified right off the get-go is during this planning meeting, while people are breaking developer types or decomposing things to tasks, testers are decomposing to test cases. Now we have two views into the application. We have a technical view of the interpretation of the requirements, and we have a tester view, tends to be more aligned with maybe potentially the business value of those interpretations as well. And when the testers finish coding, I love for testers to already have the appropriate test cases that reflect at least the acceptance criteria. Here's why. As a developer, I am going to push F5 and I'm going to walk the happy path and I'm going to walk a few other paths, right? I mean, am I right? Checks in their code without pushing F5? I mean, I'm going to do it. Why not push F5, fire up MTM, and run those four test cases? If I do that, I've immediately gotten extremely fast feedback on whether or not I have interpreted my solution to the business requirement the same way that the testers have interpreted the business solution. And that lets me get this nice check before I even promote the code to the testers. And now the testers have it. They know that a test is successfully passed. They now have a new appreciation for that code. It's not so, yeah.
So how easy would that be if there were no acceptance criteria?
Oh, man, you just write it off.
Absolutely.
It'd be so hard to do.
Yeah.
You really couldn't. I mean, without acceptance criteria, it's extraordinarily difficult to create those easy mappings for a tester. Mm-hmm. They have to come up with them on the fly. It's difficult. Yeah. And they probably won't be able to do that in the confines of a sprint. Mm-hmm. Unless they have a ginormous sprint length,
yeah.
Which wouldn't work.
ALM is about that holistic view. So we need to get our product owner, our business analyst, we need to get them to put those requirements in. We need the acceptance criteria. That feeds into the developers. It feeds into the testers. All of those things tying together back to that traceability slide you had earlier, I thought was absolutely fantastic, where you sort of showed the way things flowed together across those role-specific segments that you had there.
Mm-hmm.
I just loved that as an illustration of that traceability, and hopefully that's coming across with what you just said. I like that.
Perfect. Thank you. Okay, now I'm going to walk in and do another demo, if we can pull back to my monitor, and we're going to look at something a little bit different, which is looking at a PowerPoint storyboard. Now, a PowerPoint storyboard is this very simple, easy way. Simple and easy. That's probably excessive. But it's a relatively straightforward way for me to reflect my idea in PowerPoint. Now, I could use Visio here. I could use a bunch of other things. Microsoft shipped a bunch of other mock-up tools. There was Sketchflow. Mm-hmm. Very nice. There's a lot of good tools out there. The problem is not everybody owns them and is familiar with them. Everybody has PowerPoint, it feels like. It's ubiquitous, at least in the industries that I work in.
And how much time do you need to spend on training your users on using PowerPoint?
About none.
About none, right?
And in fact, what you see here, if you've never seen storyboarding, will be full all the training you need for storyboarding, right? So here's my storyboard, and I'm not going to specify a big storyboard and build it all from scratch in the interest of time, but let me pop over here and take a look. I just went and grabbed a screenshot. And I've drug over my screenshot and put it in here. And this is my Bing search improvement idea. Okay? And I shouldn't have moved all my stuff around. Oh, well. So here I have my Bing search improvement idea. And I've got a couple things in here. I want to add some maps. So when I go in and I search for something here, I want to make sure that it returns a map. So I might animate this, and if I push F5, you can kind of see it. I'll go slowly for the screen. When I click here, you can see the mouse moving. There's some little animation. It clicks inside of there, and then it spells out Lorem Ipsum Dolor, right? Mm-hmm. And that then, I click on the next screen, and it does the search. Here's my Bing search. Well, the thing is, if the search returns an address as the first hit, I want a map. I want to have a map here. So these are just screenshots that I've grabbed and dropped in here. But what I want to show here is I can go to the searching these storyboard shapes. These are these wonderful shapes I can use. And there's a lot of them. There's backgrounds, etc. I'm going to use a map shape once my PowerPoint begins responding. And I'm going to type map. And here's a street map. I'm going to drag it over, drop it onto here. And I may drop over a map marker to show that map piece there. And maybe I want some description. Maybe I want a text area in there. So let me grab a text area and move it over there. And did you know this? Did you know you could do this? I'm not sure. If you just say equals lorem, whoops, equals lorem, it gives you a bunch of lorem ipsum dolem. Neat little feature of PowerPoint. That's not the storyboarding, it's just PowerPoint. And you can put a quote one, and it'll just give you one sentence in there. But anyway, here I have my map, and I can then get a good idea of this storyboard. Now, I want to show a couple things, because it's specifically called out as part of the exam prep criteria on storyboards. So let's talk, let's put a new slide in here. And some of the things I can do is I can create my own storyboard shapes. Like for this example here, I simply created a shape. You know, I just created a circle and I put an arrow in it and I drug it over to my shapes, dropped it, and there I had a shape. It just Great. Added a shape. It was brilliant. And I could squeeze it down, stretch it out, squeeze it this way. Oh, that doesn't look good.
Ooh.
That's not an appropriate behavior. Well, one of the things that PowerPoint storyboarding does that I think is brilliant is it does, like if I grab my Bing background page and drop it over here, if I stretch things out and move it around, that doesn't have a scroll bar. Let me add something with a scroll bar. Here's a list. If I drag my list and put it here, watch when I stretch it way out fat. Do you see it gets really wide here on the, whoop, this is a touchscreen. If I move it around, whoops. If I grab it and drag it out really large, it gets kind of fat there. But as soon as I let it go, it skinnies up, mm-hmm. like that behavior should be. Well, if you want to create your own storyboard shapes, because I'm going to tell you straight off the bat, there's a ton of them out there, but they're not all going to meet your needs. You're going to have corporate standards. So if you want to have your own storyboard shapes, you need to do something special. And that something special is you keep, you create your own shapes PowerPoint. It's just a PowerPoint, raw PowerPoint. It has to have an initial screen that has this kind of piece. It has to have some of this stuff in the notes. Reference name, Northwest Cadence shape, the title, the category, etc. And then inside of here, we draw our shape. Okay, just the way we want our shape. Now, if I stretched it out, it's going to look ugly. Okay, so you don't stretch it out. Just
okay,
saying.
That's easy.
Just don't stretch it out. But down below, you specify some details. The tooltip should be circular navigation arrows. And then you have these key things. The layout of the right arrow and the right circle should always align to the top and to the right. The layout of the left circle should align top and left. And the layout of the rectangle should align to the top, but stretch. Mm-hmm. So what happens, and I'm going to show two, I can have this particular one here, this circular navigation arrows without the scaling. Notice I don't have any scaling on this one. I call it nav buttons, no scaling. Now that I have this, I save it, and I go to the command line, and I use a tool called TF Storyboard. And this, if I look at my directory, I have my nwcshapes.pptx in this directory. And what I'm going to do is take the TF Storyboard, and I'm going to say I want to build my storyboard, and you can pass in a question mark, and it'll tell you exactly what things you need to provide. And here's a good example right here. And let's just do TF storyboard build, and we're going to build the build archive. Yeah, sorry about that. There it is, Northwest Shapes PowerPoint. And I can hit enter. Now watch it fail. And it says, you got to close PowerPoint. I should have closed PowerPoint to start with. Let's get it all closed up. PowerPoint's closed. Let's run that one more time. And one more time. Do you see PowerPoint anywhere on my monitor?
I don't.
But it might still be running. Look at that. Got it? Killed it? Oh, for crying out loud. Oh, man. All right, more details. Processes. Can you search in here for PowerPoint? I don't see anything here. Windows processes, service hosts. It's not going to be in there. Okay, let's try it one more time. Okay.
I thought 8th time lucky was going to be a champ.
I thought so too. I'm going to fire up PowerPoint one more time, and then I'm going to close it. Who knows? You never know, right? And run that again. Oh, boo. All right.
No, we want to see the failure.
Oh, there it is. Okay. They're bringing it over to me so they're not seeing the failure. I better CLS this, right? Now you won't see the failure any longer. So
we did get that recorded somewhere, didn't we?
TFS. Oh, for crying out loud.
I love how easy we were saying, like, anyone can use PowerPoint. Using it's fine. Killing it. Whoa.
Killing it. You just can't close it, right? All right. Well, I'm so far unsuccessful at killing PowerPoint. So I'm going to leave it. But I do want to mention how this works is you pass in this build, and then you can either run the import command or do slash import. It'll take these shapes, throw them into PowerPoint, and they scale beautifully. Mm-hmm. But there's this weird process to get them into PowerPoint, which is you use this TFS storyboard utility, which just happens to be included with the power tools.
So is there any the way that you decorated the bottom of the shape? Mm-hmm. Where did you get that syntax from? Is that just documented in the help for the PowerPoint tools?
It's documented in the help for the power tools.
Okay,
absolutely.
Fantastic.
It's all in there. All right. Well, so far, no ability to kill PowerPoint. I'm gonna let that be. I don't see it. It is what it is. As long as you know that this is kind of the structure that you might use to promote those things in and get some good things. PowerPoint storyboarding is a great way to get feedback very rapidly, but you're going to want to tailor it to your own uses. Dang it, I had a technical demo and I couldn't even close PowerPoint.
So for those of you that don't know Steve, while I present the next module or the most part of it, he will be over here bashing away at PowerPoint.
No, I'm just going to be running that command again and again and again click, and again click, and click. Again and again.
And I'll be talking and you'll hear, woohoo!
Then, okay, switch back.
That's right. Just cut me right off. You wait and see.
Oh, my. All right. Back we're going to go to, and I closed my PowerPoint on my host machine as well. So nothing like just going through and closing all the PowerPoints that I'm going to need.
I'll close on mine. Would that help?
You might need to. All right. So here we are, extending the PowerPoint storyboards. Mm-hmm. Didn't work out so well. Wasn't bad. Mm-hmm. I mean, I got to the point where I got to describe the PowerPoints. Command line just couldn't hack it.
Thank you to the folk on the chat window for the remote starting that remote process on his machine. It worked a treat. I just go, enter another PowerPoint, enter another one.
All right, what the study guide says on this next section is prioritizing requirements. And this is identifying requirements that are on the critical path. This is part of the exam, part of the study preps. Identifying must-have requirements and enabling the entire team, including customers, to participate in this requirements process. Prioritization, and also identifying dependencies between requirements and communicating those dependencies. So enabling the entire team to participate in requirements prioritization. Can you give me your thoughts on that, Anthony?
My thoughts on that, that would be very, very rare. The entire team on prioritization?
It seems like a product owner role, and it seems like even if you're not doing Scrum, it's the role of somebody in an executive management role or someone responsible for the success or failure of that. Now, there are you know, software development companies like Valve, right, that have no hierarchy at all. There's no bosses. I think they're a unique and different type of organization. So I think that's the only place I'd ever see a whole team getting together to prioritize requirements.
I see that meeting just going terribly wrong.
Oh.
I see you know, so many conflicting requirements there. If we've got so many voices speaking, arguing for their feature, and I want this and I want that. That's what we're trying to keep away from the team by having the product owner. The product owner gets to go and, you know, herd those cats.
Sure.
To keep that dysfunction away from the team, to keep the distraction away.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't explain that one.
Let me give you an example. Microsoft uses we submit user voice statements, like where we vote things up and down on features that you and I want as MVPs, and everyone attending here can vote things up or down on user voice, bugs, etc. But just because they do that doesn't mean that Microsoft will put them as their number one priority. I don't know if they're going to add color to Visual Studio, for an example, right? The number one requested priority for Visual Studio.
No, Visual Studio, okay. I thought it was Rename a Team Project.
In TFS it is,
of course.
Yes. Okay, that's been up there since 2005 as the number one. So see,
one day,
it's not
one day.
Necessarily the case that they should prioritize based on, you know, the mass of people clamoring for things. So the next thing is identifying dependencies. So we'll cover some of those. First, I'm going to talk about must-have requirements. And must-have requirements are things that you must have to meet your minimum viable product. And man, people mess this up all the time. In my experience, about 75% of most must-have requirements aren't actually required to meet that minimal bar. I think smaller, folks. Think smaller batches, smaller queues, and get in this cadence of just this massively fast delivery. Not this, 6 months later, we get something to show our customers. No, 6 minutes later, get something to show your customers. Get it out there. 6 hours, 6 days. Maybe a sprint, a 2-week sprint, if that's the, you know, the shortest you can go. But focus on driving down that time so you can get feedback. So for classifying requirements, there's a multitude of different ways people do it. And some are good, some are better, some aren't so good. But the problem is there's millions, and all of them are really fairly acceptable in prioritizing, as long as you think them through. Here's one, it's Moscow. Right, MSCW, Moscow. Must have, should have, could have, would like. You know, that's one way to break things down. And the must haves, you really need to be must. Now, that's not saying that the product owner is going to say, finish the musts and ship. They may say, we need the musts and these shoulds we also really, really, really want in our first release. But if something had to give, you might be willing to give one of those shoulds and still get the product out the door so you can get feedback. Regardless of the tool, the hardest part about any of this is ruthlessly slaying requirements that are not required. I don't like the word requirement if it's not required. I think, who uses the word desirement? Somebody sprung that on me at a Scrum meeting, desirement. Because you desire them, you really want them, but they're not necessarily required. All right, the critical path. Now, just a quick definition of the critical path. It's the longest necessary path through a network of activities while respecting their interdependencies. Whew. What it means is you cannot deliver your product any shorter than the critical path unless you shorten items that are on the critical path. It requires three things. It requires a full work breakdown structure of all required activities, the time estimate for every activity, and all of the dependencies between the activities. I see three things causing problems with TFS. Full work breakdown structure is very difficult to get in TFS. You do in Scrum, we do a small plan the work, work the plan, because we're doing a little bit of breaking things into tasks. But it's such a small bit of breaking things into tasks that we really don't need a lot of dependencies and predecessors and successors. It's pretty obvious you're going to create the stored proc before you use the stored proc. You know what I mean? So you kind of don't need that complexity in Scrum. So TFS does not at all calculate your critical path. You could probably make it with some kind of fancy footwork and shucking and jiving. Don't ever do it. Microsoft Project, however, does calculate critical path for you. Now, Microsoft Project can sync with Team Foundation Server. And there are three out-of-the-box templates that you talked about, which is the CMMI, the Agile, and the Scrum template. And it interacts differently between those three based on something called the fieldmapping.xml file in the process template. And inside of that field mapping, you might have something that looks like this. Mapping work item tracking field reference name equals the STS scheduling start date, and the project field is PJ task start. And publish only is true. So anyway, we might have a bunch of these. The fact is that the CMMI template has a lot of things in there. The Agile has quite a few, and the Scrum has nothing. Right? And so the Scrum template won't tie with Project unless you modify it, other than just like some really, really basic imports of stuff. But once you've closed your Project file, you lose a lot of the data. For Agile, you don't lose very much data. In CMMI, it captures most. So let's take a look at what that might look like using Project with TFS. And I think this might actually go back and answer one of the questions that I saw scrolling by that someone mentioned, that the introduction of Project and working with TFS. So let's, again, pop over remote desktop over here. Wow. And I'm going to open up
PowerPoint.
I'm going to open up this CMMI project, and I've got a work breakdown structure here. You can see I've got a requirement, a functional requirement, and all of these subtasks for it, much like you broke down in Project, I mean in the Scrum one. I'm going to right-click this and say open it up in Microsoft Project. Now, while I'm opening it up, I'm going to look at this first work item here, create database for branch office. You know, customer can find the nearest Fabricam fiber tool. Let's go in there and open up that task. And if I look at it under all links, you'll see it's got a parent work item. That's its only link. But you know what? I probably need to create that database before I do some other things. So if I want to establish that relationship, I can do it by linking to another requirement here. But more commonly, I'll simply open it up in Project and link them that way. Now, the first thing I want to show you is we have this duration. These look like 2 days, 3 days, 2.5 days to deliver these. Where did these numbers come from? And they come out here to the end. If we add a new column here, we can look like we can pull up remaining work as one of the remaining duration. Whoops. I have remaining work. So I've got remaining work. That's the one I want. And in remaining work, I can right-click and I can... there we go. No. I guess I have to highlight them all like this. Please stop highlighting. What chicken did I not sacrifice today to the demo gods? Because I can't, no hands, and it just keeps scrolling. I'm like down at 4,000 things.
I love your demos.
Oh man, my demos stink. I'm gonna have to remote into your machine. I'm telling you here. I'm just gonna highlight a few of these. Right click and auto schedule these tasks. Oh my goodness. I'm just going to do it for a couple here, auto-schedule, so I don't run them down. When I auto-schedule them based on this remaining work, notice it synced my remaining work from TFS into here. So here I have this remaining work. But you can drag one and drop it to another to specify these predecessor-successor relationships. So you can see what I'm doing here is I'm establishing these predecessor-successor relationships. Mm-hmm. And I can do some of this stuff in a rather fancy format if I want and lay it all out and get it all scheduled. I can do the things in project that might make sense, like Brian Keller can't be starting all these things at the same time. So I could always go to my resource view and I could level that resource.
You've met him. He's a talented guy.
He is a talented guy. Notice here I've leveled his resources, so now he's just it's all laid out like this. Mm-hmm. If I do that, this is going to be the critical path. You know, there's nothing feeding it. These are just, it's only Brian. One person always is, everything's on the critical path. But that designated the critical path. I want to go back to team now and publish this back. Actually, I don't. See where this one says 16 hours, that task we were looking at? Let's grab that thing. Let's stretch it out a bit. Let's bump that up. Let's bump it up to 36 hours, just for giggles. And at this point, we can publish that back to TFS. Oh, one more thing. Let's go back to view. You can see a Gantt chart view. But you can do a tracking chart. See where it says 0%? This is percent complete. As people start updating their data in TFS, it'll start laying it out in here, and I can see it graphically here. Now, I don't want to get too excited about project because I don't want to get too excited about project. But we're going to publish this back. I probably should explain a little bit more. There's a difficulty with Microsoft Project in that once you've established a start date and an end date, work will fill the available time. It's going to take that long for people to deliver it. So let's go back in. Let's publish this back, which I think we already did. Let's go look for that requirement again. I'm going to pull open that this work item, hit F5, and now notice I have a successor for this task. I now have predecessor and successor identified. I have implementation fields that I can look at. I can see what that is. And then I've got some other things too. Notice I now have a start date and an end date for this particular task. Notice up here my effort. My original effort was 16. My remaining work is now 36. It's going to take longer to do. This is that syncing between the two. So use project where it's appropriate. Don't use it where it's inappropriate. I'm going to go ahead and close this out. Don't need to save any changes. And let's move back to the PowerPoint. Talk about a little bit on some exam best bets. So although the exam prep seems to stress this kind of formality in these requirements, don't get caught up too much in the formality. Understand where project sits. Understand that in any process improvement you make in an organization, you're going to need to take into account where the company is starting. You can't just walk in and say, throw everything out you're doing, change your culture, change your teams, and start here in Agile. There's a gradual transition that needs to take place. And that transition, you do need to know some of these waterfall-y type tools to get people to a better world. Scrum in the earlier part of today really applies here. Mm-hmm. I mean, the questions you're going to get in this section, a lot of it's going to cast back to that very beginning introduction to Scrum you got. And understand, however, if you do have to use Microsoft Project, and there are cases for it, understand where it plugs in. I would go and find those things out to understand where you might use Project. Woofta!
That was huge.
That was giant. That was longer than, honestly, I thought that was going to run.
I think we definitely deserve a break. So
I think you guys all deserve a break as well.
So I think time to top up the coffee.
Sounds good. And we'll go through and review some of those questions.
How about we see you in 10?
We'll see you in 10. Bye.